Hey there, it's Kona Gallagher, host of And Then They Were Gone and Day by Day True Crime Stories, and I'm here to bring you an amazing opportunity to win some incredible prizes, all for a good cause. Join the Texas Advocacy Project's The Big Game Football Squares Raffle on February 9th, 2025, and help support survivors of power-based abuse. For every $100 donation, you secure a square and a chance to win amazing prizes. You can choose from two exciting grids. The Hawaiian Paradise Grid offers a grand prize of a seven-night stay for two at a luxury resort in Oahu or the Big Island. Or play the Beachfront Mexico Grid for a chance to win a four-night, all-inclusive stay for two at a five-star Marival Luxury Resort in Banderas Bay or Nuevo Nayarit, Mexico. Your contributions help survivors understand their rights, navigate the justice system, and secure emergency protective orders. To participate, visit TexasAdvocacyProject.org and select your grid today. Don't miss out. Tune in to the Texas Advocacy Project's Facebook page on February 9th, 2025, during the game for live updates on winners. Prizes are awarded at the end of each quarter, with the grand prize at the game's conclusion. So score big for a cause. Visit TexasAdvocacyProject.org to learn more.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
On August 1st, 2018, 28-year-old Samantha Sayers was ready for an adventure. An experienced hiker, Sam decided to drive 2 hours away from her Seattle home and tackle Vespers Peak. The hike was only supposed to be a day trip, so when darkness fell with no word from Samantha, her boyfriend, Kevin Dares, grew concerned. Worried that she was injured, he drove out to the trail. But instead of his girlfriend, he found only her empty car. What happened next was the largest search and rescue operation in Washington state history. When Samantha wasn't found quickly, rumors began to swirl, with people wondering if there was more to the story than a woman who simply got lost. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Samantha Sayers. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reaction to questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Before we get started, we've had a few folks join us over on Patreon recently, so we want to give them a shout out. Thank you so much to Erica A., Chase C., Allison D., Rana A., and Nicole R. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you all so much.
And if you would like to join us at any level, you'll receive ad-free episodes and a copy of the ebook that I wrote. But with that out of the way, let's go ahead and get into the story of Samantha Sayers. Samantha Claire Sayers was born Samantha Claire Steinbaugh on August 13, 1990, to Lisa Yak Sayers in Girard, Pennsylvania. Girard is a small town in Erie County with a population of only about 2,900 people. I don't really have any information on Samantha's birth father, but in 2009, she legally changed her last name from Steinbaugh to Sayers after her stepfather adopted her when she was 18. Bubbly, animated, and known for always having a big grin on her face, Samantha was quick to make friends wherever she went. She was athletic and fit, and early on, she discovered a passion for hiking. Samantha attended high school at Northwest Pennsylvania Collegiate Academy, which is a college preparatory magnet school in Erie. There, she was a free spirit, and from a young age, Samantha leaned into her individuality. While she was in high school, Samantha developed a condition called alopecia. Alopecia causes sufferers to lose hair from different parts of their body, often in patches. Samantha began losing clumps of hair on her head, which would have been devastating for most high school girls, and I mean high school guys too.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's awful, but Samantha just rolled with the punches and leaned into it. Once her hair loss started, she first experimented with different wigs, but after finding out that she didn't really find them comfortable, Samantha committed to bald life.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Oh, good for her.
Yeah. So she shaved off, you know, all of her hair that remained and began what would become her signature look.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah, totally. And Samantha's mother, Lisa, supported her daughter's new look and eventually added to it herself. So when Samantha was a little bit older, Lisa designed a pattern of stars that Samantha got tattooed on her head.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
So it's like a line of stars that starts above her right ear and arcs down to the base of her skull.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. Like, I mean, and you'll see pictures of her, obviously, you know, the show art, we have a picture of her, but like, she just looks cool, you know?
Yeah.
Like every picture of her, just like, like it's intimidating, like, you know? So after graduating high school in 2008, Samantha left Pennsylvania and attended the State University of New York at Fredonia. However, she stayed close to her roots as Fredonia is only about 50 miles away from Erie. While attending SUNY Fredonia, Samantha majored in technical theater and theater design and technology, graduating with a bachelor's degree in 2013. Right after graduating from college, Samantha decided that it was time to make a bigger move than just an hour up the road. She decided to go across the country and move to Seattle, Washington, which for those of you who, you know, don't know American geography, that is 2,500 miles or 4,000 kilometers away from her home back in Girard.
Well, I find it interesting, though, that she, and, you know, excuse my ignorance of the theater scene. I find it interesting that she went to Seattle with a background in theater design.
Right. Instead of going to New York City.
Instead of going to New York City. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, so I don't know, like, what caused Seattle over that other than her love of the outdoors. Because it turned out Seattle was kind of the perfect place for someone like Sam. So on the one hand, she was now in a city, which gave her access to everything that growing up in a small town had starved her of. But on the other hand, she was only ever a stone's throw away from getting right back into the thick of nature. And, you know, having lived in New York City, like, yes, physically, you are very close to a lot of nature. But one, East Coast and West Coast hiking, totally different.
Yeah.
Totally different. And New York City, God bless it, my favorite place in the world, it makes it really hard to get out. Like, once you get into that city, like, they do not want to let you out of it. So it is not super easy to, like, just go off to a hike. Whereas in Seattle, I would imagine, you know, you just get in your car and you go.
Yeah, I mean, the city itself of Seattle isn't really that large.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it is surrounded by mountains and nature.
Exactly.
I mean, it's anywhere you look, there's the city skyline with a mountainous backdrop or the sound.
Yeah.
It's very, very nature oriented.
Right. And so in that regard, it does make sense. And she was even able to use her degree when she got to Seattle. So she found work as a properties artisan in Seattle Rep, which is the biggest nonprofit theater in the Pacific Northwest.
Wow.
So, I mean, honestly, like, you know, it's tough when you graduate from college getting a job in your field, regardless of what your field is, but especially if it's like a more artistic field like that.
Yeah.
So the fact that she was able to go off and do that immediately is incredibly impressive. And then, so it sounds like a win-win, you know? She got everything that she was kind of looking for at that point. Now, I'm assuming, you know, the theater work, even though it's what she wanted to do, it probably didn't pay a whole lot, considering it's also a nonprofit, you know? People aren't generally getting rich off of those. So Sam put her entrepreneurial spirit to good use and got a side hustle cleaning Airbnbs and also was working on flipping houses. But when Samantha wasn't working, she was hiking. She wasn't one to keep still, and nothing was ever dull and boring when she was around. It was this energy that would draw Kevin Dares to her in 2015. The pair met on Tinder, but quickly found that they had a lot in common. Kevin didn't work a normal 9-to-5 either and was in a similar field, having a business that managed properties, renovations, and real estate. They became serious very quickly, and before anyone knew it, Samantha and Kevin were living together. It was this connection that allowed Kevin to figure out that something had gone horribly wrong with Samantha's latest hiking trip within hours of not hearing from her. One of the things that excited Samantha the most about living in Seattle was Vesper Peak. The first thing that anyone in the know will warn others about Vesper Peak is that it's not for novice or amateur hikers. This 8-mile round trip reaches over 6,000 feet above sea level. It has jagged terrain and thick underbrush that could hide pretty much anything and everything. There are also no bridges across any of the bodies of water along the way. So couple all of that with the harsh weather and the biting Washington cold, and you have a recipe for potential disaster, if you're not prepared.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like just like a day hike kind right. of a thing.
And that's the thing, too, because like I've never been hiking on the West Coast. So I do feel like it's very different and potentially more treacherous than the hikes that I've been on over here on the East Coast.
I mean, it seems like it.
Yeah.
I've never been hiking on the West Coast either, but like, does not sound like something you would typically find over here on the East Coast, unless you're talking about going deep into the mountains.
Exactly. Yeah. But like we've been saying, Samantha Sayers was an experienced hiker. She was used to being outdoors and used to places like Vesper Peak, where there's no infrastructure, very little to no self-coverage, and it's deep in the untamed wilderness. It was a challenge for her for sure, but Samantha loved a challenge. In July 2018, Samantha made a post on Facebook that read, quote, "Seattle friends, I'm going hiking this Wednesday and tackling Vesper Peak. Message me if you want to tag along," end quote. Unfortunately, no one was able to take her up on her offer. Kevin, who is a native of New Orleans, Louisiana, would often go hiking with his girlfriend, but he was not an experienced hiker like she was.
I mean, yeah, from New Orleans, yeah. Like they're below sea level. So I can't imagine there's a whole lot of hiking going on around New Orleans.
Exactly. Yeah, it was definitely not something that he grew up doing. So much so that he was the type of dude who would just take off and hike in jeans.
Perfect.
Yeah. So Vesper Peak was like not really his scene.
Yeah.
But it was also a Wednesday morning, you know, and he was busy with work and as I'm sure a lot of her friends were, so like he couldn't take off time to join her. And look, if I'm in Samantha's position, 9 times out of 10, like no one being up for the hike would just mean that I would stay in bed. But obviously, I am not Samantha. She was not deterred, and early on the morning of August 1st, 2018, she set off on the 2-hour drive to the mountain to hike it on her own. When Samantha arrived, she parked her blue Ford Fiesta right beside where the trail to the summit begins on the Mountain Loop Highway and signed her name in the registry. She was dressed in workout leggings and a sports bra and came equipped with hiking poles and a black backpack that held food and water. She also had her cell phone, but knew that the coverage up on the mountain was spotty at best. Kevin had texted her during the drive, so before she set off, she made sure to text him back in case she didn't have service later. In the text, he just reminded her to be careful and to call if she needed anything. "Okay, baby, I love you," Samantha wrote back. With her outfit, bald head, and star tattoos, Samantha stood out, and subsequently, several other hikers remember seeing her that day. She was especially noticeable at the top of Vesper Peak because few hikers actually make it that far. Witnesses later recalled seeing her up there as she took a well-deserved break with a view to eat her lunch before starting her descent down the south side of the summit. She flashed passersby with her usual big grin and then walked into the wilderness. Because Samantha was an experienced hiker, she knew the importance of not only signing in on the logbook, but also giving someone else clear plans about what she was going to be doing that day. That's why, before leaving that morning, Samantha confirmed her plan with Kevin so he knew when to expect her. She left at 8 that morning and was planning to be home by 6. But 6 o'clock came and went, and Samantha didn't come home. Now, that in and of itself wouldn't have been terribly alarming. I mean, it was a 2-hour drive after all, and hikes can take longer than expected. But even if she wasn't home by 6, Kevin expected to have heard from her by then.
Right.
She should have at least been at her car or close enough to her car that she would have had cell service. And, you know, she could have just sent him a quick text or called him to just say, hey, like, the hike went long, going to be home later than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
As the day began to draw to a close, the pit in Kevin's stomach grew. Not willing to wait around any longer, he got in his own car and set off on the 2-hour drive up to Vesper Peak, only stopping at a gas station to pick up a flashlight.
Is it safe to assume that he has texted her, called her?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure we're getting to the point where I'm sure that the police investigated him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we will talk about that because we've done, almost 200 episodes by this point, right? And so if you hear, like, okay, boyfriend says that a woman went hiking.
Yeah.
She didn't come back. Well,
he's obviously the suspect.
Like, let's be for real, dude.
Sure.
But a ton of people saw her and she stood out.
And she was alone. And I'm sure Kevin had an alibi.
Right. And because of cell phones, you know, triangulation things, they can prove that he was in Seattle, like he was not at Vesper Peak. And, you know, nobody ever saw anybody who remotely looked like him.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And so it's not
one of those typical cases.
It's not
cases.
One of those. Yeah. That we've covered many times before on this show. Basically, it's starting to get dark by this time. By the time he's like, all right, something's wrong, because he knows, like, she's not going to be out in the dark willingly. So he's not a hiker. He doesn't have like a bunch of supplies. So like I said, he jumps in his car, just literally goes to a gas station, picks up a flashlight, and is like, okay, I'm going to go find her. So best case scenario, he thinks that he'll start driving. She'll call him and say, hey, sorry.
Yeah. And then he'll turn around and.
Yeah. Right. And okay, he has a little like wasted time.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Right.
But then worst case scenario, like, she's hurt and he can hopefully go and help her. But Samantha never called him during the 2-hour drive. So by the time he arrived at Vesper Peak, it was already dark.
Do we have rough estimates of when those hikers last saw her?
So I think that the last hiker...
When she was beginning her descent, right?
Yeah, when she was beginning her descent and she was eating lunch. So, yeah. You know, like midday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Noonish.
Yeah, noon one. I mean, you
sometime
know, just
around
some
there.
Some midday time. And that makes sense, right? Because if she was expecting to be home by 6, that means she was expecting to leave by 4, give or take, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, anytime noon 1-2, like in that kind of time period. So we're talking August. Mm. So it gets dark at like 8, 9 o'clock.
9 o'clock probably, yeah.
So it's been several hours since there have been any confirmed sightings of her. So he pulled up, you know, at the trailhead and immediately saw Samantha's car because it was the only one there. Using only a flashlight, Kevin then started on the trail, calling out for Samantha and hoping to spot her along the way. He searched for as long as he could, but Vesper Peak is dangerous during the day, let alone at night. And again, Kevin is not an experienced hiker. So the trail that Samantha went on is called the Sunrise Mine Trail. It first goes through a forest and then across a river filled with boulders and then up a hillside that just keeps getting more difficult the higher up you go. During the search, Kevin walked over 3 miles of the trail, but fell and ended up breaking his flashlight. So he was then forced to turn around and pick his way back to his car in the dark.
He didn't even have like a flashlight on his cell phone?
Yeah, it didn't say if he did or not. He might not have brought his phone because I think he might have already lost service by then.
Right.
So he might have just like left it in the car. I'm not exactly sure. So it was close to midnight by the time he made it back to his car. From there, he called police from the visitor center and reported Samantha missing. Because, I mean, he knows like something bad happened, right? Like her car's there. He couldn't find her. Nothing good is going on.
Yeah.
So he calls and reports her missing, and at around 1:30 a.m., search and rescue sergeant John Q. Adams arrived.
Yes. Really?
John Quincy Adams. Well, I don't know if the Q actually stands for Quincy, but yes, his name is John Q. Adams. He and Kevin searched for a bit, but there was really not much that they could do at that point.
Yeah, I mean, not on foot at night. regardless
at 1:30 in the morning.
Yeah, regardless of how powerful a flashlight you have, like,
yeah,
you're not going to be able to cover a large area like that.
No,
with any, you know, significant findings.
No, not at all. And so, like I said, they did what they could, but it wasn't a lot. So Sergeant Adams called in the cavalry, and the search began in earnest at 6 a.m. with hopes that they would find her soon. Now, again, Samantha was not just some random tourist who decided to take this hike willy-nilly. She had the experience and she had the proper supplies. At this point, people are thinking that she's out there, probably injured.
That would be my guess, yeah.
Yeah, right? Like, she fell, she broke her ankle, you know, couldn't move. But, like, she's there, she had food, she had water. Yes, 12 hours, give or take. Like, that's a long time to be missing. But it's survivable if it's just a broken ankle or something, you know?
Right. You're also talking about August 1st. In Seattle. I mean, the temperatures at night, probably not freezing.
Yeah.
Like, it's definitely a survivable situation.
Exactly. So I think when the search began, like, people, you know, were nervous, of course, but, like, the hopes were high that this was going to be resolved quickly. And her car and her signature in the logbook confirmed that Sam had indeed arrived at Vesper Peak the day before. And as I mentioned earlier, a witness also spotted her at different stages of the hike. And thanks to her unique look, it was very easy to say, yes, it was her and not just some other person who looked like her.
Right.
You know, and I was thinking about that when I was writing this, because it's like, if it were me, for instance, if you see me hiking on a mountain, like, I am a very generic white woman with brown hair, you know?
I disagree.
But you know what I mean? Like, if somebody said that they saw me, like, I have brown hair and a ponytail, like,
yeah, sure.
It would
and
be
you
very
probably
easy.
Would be wearing a hat or something. Like, you know, yeah, it's a bald head with tattoos
and a sports bra
and a sports
and
bra.
Like
yeah, that's
walking.
That
poles.
Is a very, that is a very unique look.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that helps because there are so many other cases that we've talked about where there have been mistaken sightings, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, no, I did see this person. And then it just turns out to be somebody who looks like them. But in this particular case, especially because she got up to the peak, which a lot of people don't get to,
right?
Like, it's very, very, very likely that no, they saw Sam. And other hikers were also able to confirm which direction Sam had descended down the summit. So that helped incredibly to narrow down the search area. But despite the solid start, neither Samantha nor any of her belongings were found that day. Once searchers realized this wasn't going the way they had assumed it would, search and rescue teams brought in the big guns. They had helicopters in the air using thermal imaging to try to find her, and canine teams on the ground trying to track her scent. The frenzy of activity and influx of volunteers was stoked in part by Kevin's posts on Facebook. He very quickly created a group dedicated to raising awareness of Sam's disappearance and started a GoFundMe page to raise money to fund the search. He eventually raised $60,000, and Samantha's case began to get media attention. But before all that, like, when he's first starting the search and when he's first starting to make Facebook posts, he was seemingly so wrapped up in finding Samantha that he didn't actually let her family know that she was missing.
Ooh.
Yeah. Her mom, Lisa, found out that her daughter was missing through the Facebook posts.
Hey, that's not a good look.
No, it really isn't. And I mean, as a mother, like, what an awful way to find out something like that. So once she realized what was happening, Lisa immediately flew to Seattle, desperate to help in any way that she could. She provided search and rescue teams with some of Sam's clothing and joined Kevin online to help spread word about the search. But the going was tough. The jagged terrain cut up with river crossings and steep drops made things difficult. The thick underbrush made it nearly impossible to spot anything hiding within. The truth was, search and rescue teams and volunteers alike could be standing right next to the person they were looking for and not even realize it. On August 23rd, 2018, after 22 days of scouring the mountain, the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office called off the search. They'd spent thousands of hours and thousands of dollars looking for Sam. In fact, it was the longest search in state history, and all they had to show for it was a probable footprint. So after 22 days and all of these resources,
nothing,
not even a hiking pole.
That's wild.
Like, that's the part that I find crazy.
And the canines didn't hit on anything.
Nope.
Wow.
I mean, she had a backpack, she had water, she had, you know, like, she had items with her.
Yeah.
I'm assuming because she was just dressed in sports bra and the leggings, that she probably had extra clothes in the backpack too.
I mean, maybe. I mean, maybe her clothes were in her car.
Maybe, but listen, you're not a woman. Like, if I'm...
That's true, I am not.
Yeah, if I'm going somewhere, like, I'm taking layers, like, I'm always taking a jacket, I'm taking... Because you never know, like, what the temperature is going to do. Mm-hmm. She had a lot of items with her, and not a single one turned up in that search. But Kevin and Lisa were not giving up on finding Samantha. The day after the official search ended, Kevin and Lisa used the GoFundMe money to start their own search. Volunteers still offered their services too. There were self-proclaimed mountain men, friends and family, people with drones, and a woman with a search and rescue dog who all gave their time and effort, putting their own safety at risk.
And still nothing.
Nope. They all came back empty-handed. That was when Kevin turned to Bud. Carlton Bud Carr Jr. is a character by any definition of the word. Born in 1978 in San Bernardino Valley, California, Bud had what could have been the beginnings of a normal life. His father was a successful businessman who owned a mining company that he planned on passing on to Bud, but it all went awry when Bud fell in love. He was still only a teenager when his girlfriend's father approached him with a proposition to make a quick buck. He convinced Bud that there was no harm in breaking the law because the law and society as a whole were about to collapse entirely. Which, I mean, I can get behind that reasoning.
Okay. I'm waiting to hear what this crazy plan was.
Well,
to
it break wasn't the law. Yeah, it wasn't as crazy as you would expect with, like, you know, an intro like that. It's like, listen, the law is a sham. Society is about to collapse. Like, let's do crimes. The plan was basically one night, Bud and six other guys dressed up all in black and broke into a store. There, they stole somewhere between 80 and 100 guns that they then planned on selling. But Bud was caught and spent 5 years in a Missouri state prison.
I mean, I can think of a lot of easier ways to, like, make money illegally than stealing guns and then selling them.
Yeah, like, 80 to 100, too. Like,
yeah.
That's conspicuous.
Yeah, I mean, when you said
and with, like,
stealing
six
guns and, you know, the person saying that society was going to fall apart, I'm thinking...
They're going to build a bunker and, like, do,
yeah, cult,
you know,
yeah, start a cult. Shit or whatever, yeah. But, like,
no.
The plan was to sell guns?
I guess.
Why not just go rob a place that had a lot of money?
Yeah, I don't know. Clearly, it wasn't the best plan.
Yeah.
So... Bud ends up in prison, and during his time there, he was known to be argumentative and a bit aggressive. He was also put into solitary, but calmed down once he'd converted to Buddhism. Still a young man when he was released, Bud started over and became a carpenter. He married, had three children, and moved to Washington with his family. There, he became known as the loud and gruff man with a lot of confidence and a love of all things military. But when Bud discovered the concept of volunteer search and rescue operations, he was hooked. So it was Samantha's disappearance that brought Bud into Kevin's life. Bud volunteered his expertise for the small fee of $500 a week, and he went up the mountain. Now, this automatically caused controversy because many accused Bud of profiteering off of other people's grief. But Kevin disagrees. He said that Bud didn't want the money. Like, he tried to turn it down on several occasions, in fact, but Kevin insisted because, like, Bud was going up there, like, every day. I mean, he was, like, staying up on the mountain and, you know, putting his life at risk. Like, it was intense what he was doing. And Kevin had all this GoFundMe money for the search. So he was just like, let me give you, like, something, you know, and $500 a week, I'm sorry, is not a lot of money. Like, that's an even worse get rich quick scheme than stealing 80 to 100 guns, you know? So as the days and weeks wore on and the other volunteers began to drift away, Bud was the only one who stuck with Kevin during the weeks of treacherous climbs on Vesper Peak and the surrounding wilderness. Kevin and Bud ended up spending 126 days together on the mountain.
Wow. Not only like is that crazy for somebody that's experienced, like Bud.
Yeah.
But like the fact that Kevin was going along with him for all of these days, yep. Like no experience doing any long-term hikes or anything like that. And then, you know, to stick with this for that long, I mean, that shows just how much he really was in love with Sam.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, it completely physically transformed him, as you can imagine, just like, you know, hiking basically for 126 days straight.
Yeah.
It obviously mentally, who knows, you know, what he was going through. But yeah, 126 days, these two dudes up on a mountain.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm. But after months had passed, with still nothing to show for the thousands of dollars being spent on the search for Sam, that's when the rumor mill like really started picking up. People started asking, like, wait a second, where exactly is all the money that has been donated to this cause going? Some internet sleuths then started to look into everybody involved. So they started to look into Kevin, they started to look into Bud, and they believed that they found the answer when Bud posted a picture of himself lying on the floor in this I love how this is like their gotcha moment. So Bud posted a picture of himself lying on the floor surrounded by expensive freeze-dried meals. Expensive freeze-dried meals.
Like MREs?
Yes. Like the kind of shit you go to REI,
yeah,
and buy for a camping trip.
Those aren't that expensive.
I mean, they're kind of pricey.
Sure, for a meal.
Yeah.
But you're not talking about thousands upon thousands of dollars.
And again, like hoarding these is not a way to get rich. And I'm sure after 126 days, that he legit needed them.
Like, yeah, I would say so.
There's not a Wendy's up on that mountain.
No.
So when they're digging into Bud, they also uncovered his criminal record.
Sure.
And a picture of Bud with a swastika tattoo.
All right. That's probably not good, but not indicative of anything.
Well,
related,
I mean,
to this.
No. Yeah. That's the thing. It's like not related to this. I wouldn't say it's not indicative of anything. It's indicative that he maybe is a Nazi. But
okay. But wait. I mean, was the swastika canted right? Because didn't you say he was Buddhist also?
That is so funny that you brought that up because, yeah, that was actually what he said. But all right. Let's also be for real. Okay. Sure. Maybe.
I'm not saying it was Buddhist, the best choice of tattoo,
no,
but.
Buddhists
but
know that you can't do a fucking swastika tattoo.
No, I understand
they know,
but
right?
If you go to China and you go to any, there's swastikas everywhere. It's not tilted the way that it was
right.
Used for the Nazi party, but that symbol was very Buddhist before the Nazis took it.
Exactly. But it's the same reason you can't name your kid Adolf or wear a tiny
little
mustache.
I'm not defending the choice of the tattoo. I'm simply saying that maybe it wasn't related to Nazism and maybe it's related to Buddhism.
Okay.
Still not the best choice.
More likely, he was a white teenager who spent 5 years in a Missouri
state
prison.
That could also be true. Yes.
Like, let's be fucking for real,
sure,
for a second. Like,
yeah,
it's a Nazi tattoo. But again,
what does that have to do with him searching for Sam on a mountain?
Right. And I'm not saying like, let's all hang out with Nazis.
No.
Okay. I do not want a single fucking Apple review saying I'm telling you to hang out with Nazis. Again, it's just, it seems as though the online sleuthing was getting a little bit out of control at this point.
Grasping at straws.
Yeah. And despite the growing tension and noise online, Kevin and Bud continued to search for Sam. Much to the chagrin of people on the internet, Bud remained in charge of the online campaign. And look, from a PR point, I totally get this. You do not want a guy with a swastika tattoo in charge of your online campaign. Like, that's not a good look,
sure,
regardless.
But you also have to think, like you said, like, this is probably taking a tremendous mental toll on Kevin.
Exactly.
Like, I'm sure he didn't have it within his bandwidth to be going out on this mountain every day looking for the love of his life and then come home and spend a couple hours on Facebook.
Right. Like, and you're absolutely right, because at this point he was falling apart at the seams. So yes, as if continually living in the wilderness wasn't physically taxing enough, he also started drinking too much.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, right? And smoking and, you know, just numbing his pain in any way that he could while doing this incredibly physically taxing work, right? So he lost an incredible amount of weight, and he was not like a big guy to begin with, but I mean, he was skin and bones and just kept going despite his health falling apart. But after months, when the first snow fell for winter, he knew that it was time to call off the physical search. The official investigation concluded that there were four possible and probable ways that Samantha experienced an accident that day. All of them included slips or falls either into an icy crevasse where Sam couldn't climb back out, or into Vesper Lake itself. This, they explained, was how Sam both met her end and why there are no traces of her body for the search and rescue teams to find afterwards. And my only issue with this is I just feel like if she would have fallen into the lake, like, and I don't know what kind of hiking poles she had.
I was just going to say that. Something's going to float.
Something's going to fucking float.
Yes. Yeah, I don't buy that her and all of her equipment just sank to the bottom.
Like her water bottle?
Yeah.
How does a water bottle sink to the bottom?
Right. But did anybody search the lake?
Yeah, I mean, it was months, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, they searched everywhere.
And still nothing. And
there were places that weren't accessible. But again, at the beginning, they had drones, they had dogs. You know, they had ways of searching where people couldn't access, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
it doesn't seem plausible that nothing of hers was found.
Right.
And if so, that was the case.
Exactly. And so that's like kind of when the conspiracy theories start, right? Yeah, okay. Because like if you can't find an explanation that makes any sense, you got to go to the explanations that don't make sense. You know what I mean? And that's kind of what started to happen.
So we're going the opposite of Occam's razor? like the simplest solution is probably the right one? No, we're going to go the opposite and be like, the most radical, ridiculous fucking thing you can think of is probably the solution. So where are we? Aliens?
No.
Is that what's happening?
It doesn't get that bad. But it's like, okay, we went with the simplest solution, but couldn't find any indication that that's what happened.
Yeah.
So you do kind of have to go out from there. About a year after Samantha's disappearance, Kevin didn't know what happened to her. I mean, you know, like I said, he assumed that she did have an accident of some sort on the mountain and they just hadn't been able to locate her. Obviously, by this point, they knew that she was no longer alive. And so he and about 15 of Samantha's friends and family returned to Vesper Peak to commemorate her birthday. Sam had gone missing only about a week before she was due to turn 28. Kevin later wrote, quote, "As we choose life, adjust to the new realities, and consciously put one foot in front of the other, we can also recognize that we never move on. We will forever carry Samantha within us and through every step we take," end quote. They erected a metal cross with Sam's name, birthday, and Queen of the Stars inscribed on it at the beginning of the trail, and they did the best that they could to find what little closure was possible. Now, one surprising part of this service was that Lisa Sayers was not in attendance. And she didn't attend because she didn't believe that her daughter was on that mountain.
Okay.
So this is where we're getting into the other theories. I think that, you know, by this point, Kevin, after spending so much time on the mountain, just concluded that he couldn't find her. Lisa concluded that she wasn't there and something else happened. So while she and Kevin had worked together in the beginning, As the weeks and months wore on with zero sign of her daughter or any of her belongings, Lisa began to doubt that Samantha had actually had a hiking accident. Instead, she began to believe that someone had taken Samantha off of that mountain. But that wasn't her first theory. After the snow ended the unofficial search for Sam in the fall of 2018, Lisa started her own Facebook group titled Love, Light, and a Miracle. During the first months that it was active, Lisa made it clear that she believed that Sam was still alive and on the mountain, but then that shifted after she and her family hired a private investigator. She then hinted that she believed that Sam had been taken by a sex trafficking ring. And, you know, to be clear, like, that is not how sex trafficking rings work. They don't snatch people off of mountains. However, Washington State is a hotbed for sex trafficking and human trafficking in general.
Sure. But I mean, like you said, it's typically done by grooming subjects and having them kind of almost voluntarily start to do these things. It's not typically forced kidnapping.
They're not hiking their asses up, like, you know, 6,000 feet to snatch some random lady.
Right.
Like, that's not how that works. So her theory then took another turn and moved closer to home. Lisa had also hinted at, but didn't flat out say, that she believed that Kevin was somehow behind Sam's disappearance.
I mean, aside from grasping at straws and in desperation to want to keep the thought of your daughter being alive, what is this theory based on?
Well, so that's the problem, because she wouldn't give details because she didn't want to compromise the investigation. But she has implied that Kevin was abusive and controlling and that Sam wanted out of the relationship. And hidden in between her words is the implication that Sam intentionally disappeared that day to escape Kevin, or that maybe Kevin killed Sam so that she couldn't leave him.
But he has an alibi. He was several hours away in Seattle.
Right.
And witnesses saw her, a very unique look, on the mountain by herself.
Correct. While Kevin and Bud were still up on the mountain searching, Lisa cut off all contact with Kevin and told reporters, quote, "We don't care what the people there are doing," end quote, meaning Kevin, Bud, and any other volunteers. Lisa held on to hope that Sam would be found and that she would be found alive. Quote, "There's truth out there and we're going to get it," end quote. Lisa has since said that she will keep quiet about anything she knows until, quote, "the truth comes to light," end quote. So that's the thing. Like, she never came out and said that she thinks Kevin did anything. She never came out and said that Samantha ran away. She just kind of implied these things and has said that, like, my private investigator doesn't want me to talk about any of this.
I mean, okay, that definitely makes sense. But how long has this been going on and her private investigator hasn't gone to the police with anything or said anything about, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. It's tough too, because like a lot of all of this kind of back and forth on Facebook and stuff has been deleted in the years since. So like her Facebook group doesn't exist anymore. Right. So I can't go and like look at the old posts or anything like that. So I'm kind of relying on like
what others are
past
saying,
news articles and things like that about it.
Right.
And it did become very polarizing on the internet, you know, kind of like what we were saying. So, you know, they were looking into Bud, finding out all this stuff about Bud. And then like, and this isn't during the search. This is, you know, like way after the search and everything, when Kevin's trying to pick up his life together, he was spotted on a dating app. And so people are like, okay, well, you know, that's suspicious. He didn't really love her, you know, blah, 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 blah. But like this, he wasn't on Tinder like while he was on the mountain searching for her, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just,
I mean, it's, we're doing it here and we do it as part of our show, the Monday morning quarterbacking of everybody's behavior and, and what seems suspicious and what doesn't. But really, nobody knows what anybody is going through or how they're going to react in these situations.
And what a crazy situation, you know?
Exactly.
And again, to like meet up with this like ex-con dude and just spend 3 months up on a mount, 4 months up on a mountain with him. Like,
yeah, I mean, that seems like a crazy situation.
Yeah.
It seems like something that, you know, a maybe a sane person wouldn't do. However, if you're in that situation and you're desperate to try and find your girlfriend, and this guy shows up and clearly he knows how to get up on the mountain, and the rest, you know, law enforcement has given up, and you may not have any other volunteers there, but you get this guy. I mean, I could see it.
Yeah, you're going to cling to him. And
yeah.
And the two of them have stayed friends. In the years since his girlfriend disappeared on what was just supposed to be a short day hike, Kevin has done his best to move on. I mean, he...
What else are you going
to
do?
He had to continue to live his life. But even in his own speech at Sam's vigil, he admitted that it was impossible to really move on. Since calling off the official search for Sam, Kevin, who, again, never a big hiker, has found himself a part of the volunteer search and rescue teams that go up Vesper Peak, and he credits this new calling to Bud Carr. Kevin later said, quote, "I'll owe Bud for the rest of my life. People can say whatever they want. That man steps up more than anybody I've ever met, despite his faults," end quote. The two are known to work searches together, and Kevin himself was the one to recover another missing person's remains on Vesper Peak. When Bud and the rest of the team reached Kevin and the remains, Kevin reportedly broke down and asked Bud, "Why can't I find Sam?" How heartbreaking to fail in the one mission you have. And then the feeling of being able to bring
someone else
home.
Yeah.
But not the person you wanted to find. But it's a question, why can't I find Sam, that everyone who has followed this story is still asking. Could an experienced hiker like Sam really have just gotten lost or hurt and then disappeared without a trace? Was it possible that she'd actually made it off the mountain and something happened to her then? Or did she disappear of her own volition? Or was she met with foul play of some sort? The official search and rescue team believes that Samantha died after an accident. And on average, around 350 people do die each year on U.S. national park land.
Right. But how many of them are found?
Most of them.
Right.
Right. And
or some trace of them is found.
Exactly. Yeah. And unfortunately, I couldn't find, I did look for the stats on that, but I couldn't find the stats. You know, and it's tough because like Vesper Peak is a tough and dangerous trail. But on their website, the Washington Trails Association touts Vesper Peak's relative safety, saying, quote, "As off-trail scrambles go, this is one of the most straightforward, which makes it ideal for beginners. It's mostly low-angle rock, making a major fall relatively unlikely. This isn't to say there is no risk. Falls of 10 to 20 feet are certainly possible in places, and it's also possible to wander into parts of the mountain with greater exposure, but accidents and injuries here are rare," end quote.
I mean, that doesn't sound like what was described.
I know.
By
anyone.
Anybody that was searching for Sam.
Exactly. Like everybody, and I did read articles, there's a really great, and we link to it, but there's a really good, like, long form article on that really goes into the nitty gritty of the search. And it talks about, like, how physically treacherous it was. And while, yes, 99.99% of people, like, make it down fine, that doesn't mean that accidents don't happen there. I mean, Kevin, like we just said, found the remains of another missing hiker.
Right.
And over the years, several people have died while hiking Vesper's Peak. But to my knowledge, they were all recovered. If you search for disappearances on Vesper's Peak, that search only brings up one name, Samantha Sayers. Did the woman with a one in a million personality become a one in a million statistic? Or, as her mother believes, is there more to her story?
To even say, like, she came off the mountain and then left on her own with nobody seeing her,
yeah,
without somebody picking her up, you know what I mean? Like, without any more evidence of her, of somebody helping her skip town. She didn't walk off the mountain after this hike and then walk 20 something miles to somewhere else to start a new life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. While the official search ended years ago, those who loved Samantha Sayers are still searching for answers in their own ways. And hopefully one day they'll find them. Samantha Sayers has been missing from the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest since August 1st, 2018. She's a white female with a bald head and hazel eyes. She was 5'8" and approximately 125 pounds at the time of her disappearance. She has a tattoo of stars on the left side of her head and multiple ear piercings. She was last seen wearing workout leggings, a sports bra, hiking boots, and carrying a black backpack and hiking poles. Samantha was 28 when she disappeared. She would be 33 today. If you have information regarding the disappearance of Samantha Sayers, please contact the Snohomish County Sheriff at 425-388-3393. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher, with additional research by Nikki Elmas. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!